Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. Just pause for a second while I look this up. We are in episode... This is episode XXXIV, Titus and the Siege of Jerusalem. When we last left Titus, he was living in the reflected glory of his father, the great Vespasian. Coattails, I'll have me some of those. But in this episode, we learn, from the Roman's perspective, why he gets to wear the coat himself. The big victory for Titus came in the war against Judea, when he laid siege to Jerusalem and took it with a tremendous show of force. No matter where you fall for the interpretation of these events, for the Romans it was an astounding victory, and one that made Titus a legend amongst emperors. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Titus was born in 39 CE, right at the end of the year, 30th of December, and he's born in Rome, which is not the case for lots of emperors. They're often born various places around Italy, and in the next century they're going to start being born outside of Italy. So he's a rare case of an emperor who is actually born in Rome, but of course when he's born, nobody knows he's destined to be emperor at all because his father is a member of the equestrian ranks at that point, reasonably humble.
His father still has a lot of sway to give him a good upbringing. So he's one of three children. He's the eldest, isn't he?
He is the eldest, yes.
With a sister and a brother. Mm-hmm. And what kind of upbringing does the young Titus have?
Well, he is close to the imperial household, so not that humble, because Vespasian is close to that household, because Vespasian has served with members of the imperial family in the military. So he actually gets to have contact with one of our previous emperors, Claudius, who seems a long way back now, but he is just before Nero. And he is educated with Claudius's son, Britannicus. So he's around in the imperial household in the 50s CE. And that means he's got access to the sphere of power, really, and that he's getting a very good education, of course. And Suetonius tells us that actually brings him into danger because the rumor was that Britannicus was poisoned by Nero to get rid of him as a challenge to being emperor, and that Titus was at the same banquet and ate some of the same food and became quite ill but did survive.
Right. So very close to the...
Indeed. To the so close he's sharing food.
Yeah, close to the flame. So he enters the military and becomes a general. And we've had some overlap, I suppose, between this and the story of his father, Vespasian, because the most notable military accomplishment that he has is over in Jerusalem fighting the wars there with his father. Fast forwarding and jumping over that kind of thing a bit, what was Titus's contribution in the war?
Well, Titus becomes really important because halfway through the war in Judea, Vespasian is called back to Rome because he's been acclaimed emperor. So Vespasian needs to leave someone there that he trusts to finish off the job for him, as it were. And he can trust his son Titus not to do... Remember, this is in a year of civil war. So what everybody's been doing, all the generals have been doing, is waiting for their army to acclaim them emperor and then they can go in. And we've had that happen already four times. Mm. So maybe if he'd left another general there, that would have been a possibility because there are a lot of troops involved in this. So if you've got a lot of legions, you can be a danger. But of course, leaving his son there, that's less likely because his son will be his heir. So he leaves Titus there to take care of the job and Titus is very keen to finish it off quickly.
Can we start by talking about sources a bit? What are we dealing with when we're talking about the war in Judea and specifically the siege of Jerusalem? What do we have to work from?
As we mentioned with Vespasian, we've got Josephus, who is a Jewish Roman writer who's writing in Greek, who writes an account of the Jewish war. So he's one of the main sources. We've also got Suetonius writing the biography of Titus, but he writes very little about that because he's got to cover the whole of Titus's life and he just doesn't devote very much time to the war in Judea, either with Vespasian or with Titus. We've also got Dio Cassius, the Roman history, which we always have pretty much, although at this point we're dealing with an epitome, which means that it's reduced. That's true for a lot of Dio, but it's still fairly detailed. Dio is a good source, although somewhat later, again writing in Greek. And we've still got Tacitus, but only just. And Tacitus fades out on us at a point where we really might want him to go on, actually right in the middle of this conflict. This is Tacitus's histories, which stop early in book five.
Not stop because he didn't write it, stop because we've lost it.
Because we have lost it, yes. And in fact, we know the rest of it must have existed because he wrote it before he wrote the Annals, which is the work that deals with the Julio-Claudians. So the rest of it would have existed, but it would be one of the great finds, of course.
Yeah, it's hidden in a monastery somewhere, I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it.
And it would have gone to the end of Domitian's reign, who is Titus's brother, so it would have covered all of the Flavians.
Let's talk about Jerusalem as the city. Why was that significant? And why would it be attractive for Titus to try and take? Because Vespasian seemed a bit reluctant to attack it.
Well, it's significant symbolically. The Romans know that if they can take Jerusalem, then basically they will subjugate the Jews because it's such a significant religious zone for them. It still is, of course, for several religions. But certainly the temple, they know, is an extremely sacred place, and that they have had some problems in the past over, say, people like Caligula wanting statues to be put in the temple. As we know, the Romans sometimes deify their emperors, and that's a problem for monotheistic religions. So they know that this is a sacred spot and it's symbolic for the Jews. It's also extremely wealthy, as indeed the whole zone is. When they turn it into a province, they know that there will be a lot of spoils from that. So there's this double issue, I guess, of power, that it's symbolic for the Jews themselves, and therefore the Romans can make use of that, and also they can get a lot from it. So it's a significant city to take.
And essentially, if you take this, the war's over.
That's the idea. I mean, I guess if you let enough people survive, then they might start off some kind of insurgency elsewhere. But they want to wipe it out. It's been a problem for them, a bit of a thorn in their side, that there are these leaders rising up, actually lots of different factions who have been fighting each other. But the Romans are very good at unifying opposition. That idea that, you know, your enemy is my enemy, therefore we band together. And that's what happens. The Romans kind of inspire so much hatred at this point that the different Jewish factions come together to fight against them.
Why is that an attractive prospect? Well, of course, he'd want the war to end sooner or later, but why is it an attractive prospect for Titus to want to end this now-ish?
Well, he wants to get back to Rome, according to Tacitus. So one of the last bits we have of Tacitus's histories, he says that when Titus is left there in charge, he knows his father has gone back to Rome to be emperor. So, of course, that makes him the son of an emperor. He doesn't want to be faffing around in the provinces, finishing a war that could take years. I'll quote directly from Tacitus. He says, "Titus himself had before his eyes a vision of Rome, its wealth and its pleasures." So he's looking forward to all of the luxury he can enjoy there, and also the status. And he felt that if Jerusalem did not fall at once, his enjoyment of them was delayed. So he's waiting to be a party boy, is the implication.
Right. Non-refundable tickets. Want to get back to Rome.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. No hanging around.
Unfortunately for Titus, that sounds such a flippant way to put a siege, but it doesn't happen right away for him, does he? So he approaches Jerusalem, but it seems like he's going to be in for the long haul.
Yeah, he tries to negotiate at the very beginning, as Vespasian had been trying to do. So he sort of gives them terms to, you know, you will submit and there will be these terms, you will give us a certain amount of basically tax every year, but they refuse. So he decides, okay, I'm going to besiege this city. I'm going to attack this city. But of course, it's a very well fortified city. So it becomes a siege, and it's a siege that will last 7 months.
What does Titus have to work with when he's laying siege to Jerusalem?
What the Romans always had, they've got a lot of engineering and technology, at least in terms of the ancient world. They've got big siege engines and catapults. They will dig trenches, try to undermine any supplies getting into the city. Obviously, that's key because basically you're starving people out. He's got the three legions that his father has left him. Vespasian had three legions there, but he actually can call on more troops because he's also got troops in that area. He gets a legion from Syria and he draws on some legions from Egypt, from Alexandria. So he's got four legions plus a few others. quite what number that makes is always up for grabs, because the number of people in the Roman legion seems to be fairly flexible. There's a lot of scholarship on this, but somewhere around the figure of 5,000 per legion. So he's got a substantial number of troops there. The thing is, Jerusalem is a really well-fortified city. It's on a hill. That makes it hard to start with. And it's got three walls around it. Mm. And it's very tough to get through. And if you get through one, as I think Dio says, even when they do eventually get through the first wall, the second wall is harder because the defenders don't have to take care of such a large perimeter. They don't have to defend as large a perimeter as the first wall. It's bad for them that the Romans have got through one wall, but it gets increasingly difficult. It actually doesn't get easier. So that's why it takes 7 months.
So what happens in the 7 months? That's a long time for a siege to take place. It's going to have strain on both the Romans and the Jews, but there's also going to be a lot of interaction. And I seem to recall that Josephus continuously gets sent to try and negotiate with the Jews and can just continuously fails. Whether that's down to Josephus or the Jews being stubborn, I'm not too sure. There's a long time for things to happen during this, isn't there?
I think that there is a lot of stubbornness. Stubbornness sounds like a negative word, possibly, but...
When it comes to surrendering, it's not stubbornness, but yeah.
They really have a lot at stake here. And the Romans probably think that eventually, when they're weakened by not having supplies coming in, and when they keep sending people in to negotiate, that they will just give up. But they never do. Mm. They never actually do that. And they're using quite clever strategies against the Romans. And this is one of the reasons it takes so long. They seem to be deliberately sending people out who claim to be deserters. But they're clearly not deserters, because then they do things like destroying the Roman siege engines or just letting water out of barrels. The Romans have a big problem with water, water supply. The Romans always seem to take care of their supplies very carefully, but in this case, they've failed in terms of water. And this is having a strong effect on Roman morale, because there are Roman deserters who the Jews are quite happy to champion. Oh, look, people have deserted the Romans. Let's take them on to our side. Mm. But the Romans have to stop taking deserters from the Jewish side, because a lot of them are actually just plants. They're basically coming to work against the Romans. So there's a lot of quite clever strategizing going on there. There's also the Jews are digging tunnels underneath, not so much to get out, but actually, again, affect the Roman water supply, to cut it off. And Titus has to have these holes kind of bunged up with mud to stop this from happening. So there's a lot of clever to and fro. And in a way, for a while, the Romans are sort of on the hop. They don't really know how to deal with the Jewish strategies. Their siege engines are also being attacked. So the Jews will throw things over at them, throw fire over. They seem to be quite good at making sort of wooden and metal sheets that they put down the side of the wall when the Romans are trying to scale the wall, because they've got ladders and things, so that stops that from happening. They certainly can think of lots of tactics, lots of ways of making life very difficult for the Romans. And they're clearly throwing things over the whole time, throwing things over at the enemy, as you might expect, because we know that Titus was injured in one of these attacks. He had a rock thrown that hit him on the shoulder. We're told that he was always weak on that side for the rest of his life. So this siege had a lifelong effect on him.
That shows the tactics from the Jews' side. What sort of tactics were the Romans employing, just simply to wear their enemy down?
Yeah, you wear them down by, they're going to get weaker and weaker because they're not getting many supplies into the city. It sounds like the really brute force route, but that's what it is. You just keep attacking those walls and you will get thrown off and you'll get things thrown at you. So it's a very dangerous tactic, because lots of Romans get killed trying to do this. But eventually you will weaken the wall and get through. One of the main strategies with a siege is to destroy the morale of the people within the city. And you can imagine that that happens because they're not getting enough food. But also the Romans themselves are quite clever about this, because of course they know that this is a very sacred place and people want to get in order to worship at the temple.
So there's pilgrims coming from outside Jerusalem.
Exactly. Yeah. There are Jewish pilgrims coming, and they let them in, but they don't let them out again, so there are more mouths to feed. So I don't know. I suppose the religious pull must be very strong, but I don't think I'd go into a city that was under siege myself. Also, anybody who does try to get out is given the worst punishment, the worst kind of execution that the Romans have, which is crucifixion. Of course, crucifixion is a very public way of killing somebody, and you can leave them there hanging on this stake. And that's what they do. Up to 500 a day, according to Josephus, are left crucified outside the walls. It's very visible. It's something that A, deters people from leaving, and B, just sinks the morale of the people who are left inside. That's their fate. It's either death from starvation or crucified outside the walls.
So we know the Romans are being led by Titus. Do the Jews have any leadership at all?
Absolutely. They have the leaders of the previous factions who've come together, and perhaps the most well-known one is Simon Barjora, who is the leader of one of the main factions and is also seems to be a very inspirational leader, somebody that the Jews will follow. But another of the factions is a man called John of Giscala, and both of these lead the Jews throughout this siege and are actually there at the end of it as well.
After 7 months, the Romans finally get through the walls and overwhelm it. So how does this siege come to an end? How does this play out?
According to Dio Cassius, the Romans are quite reluctant to go near the temple, which is the third wall surrounds the temple. And they don't actually want to enter this space. And Titus has to kind of urge them on. And eventually the temple is set on fire, apparently by accident. And then they kind of go in and finish the job, as it were. And it's pretty clear to everybody that this siege is over. Once the third wall has been penetrated, that's the end for Jerusalem. A lot of Jewish people have been killed. Josephus says 1.1 million people. So this is a big city. And a lot of its population is gone. And there are also a lot of captives, almost 100,000. These would have been taken as slaves. And the really prominent captives, the leaders like Simon Barjora, are taken back to Rome to be marched in Titus's triumph. So they're kind of shown off and humiliated and then taken to the prison, the carcere, and strangled to death. So Josephus says that this was a pretty bloody sight, and he at this point seems to empathize quite a lot with his own Jewish people. The slaughter within, he says, was even more dreadful than the spectacle from outside. Men and women, old and young, insurgents and priests, those who fought and those who entreated mercy, were hewn down in indiscriminate carnage. The number of the slain exceeded that of the slayers. The legionaries had to clamber over heaps of dead to carry on the work of extermination. It's a nasty word, extermination.
There's a lot of nasty evocative words.
Yeah, and I guess that the rules, in as much as there are rules of war in a siege where people have not surrendered, are that you basically it's a massacre at the end.
Yeah, yeah. So this is terrible business, but business as usual.
It's not abnormal. It's just that there are huge numbers within Jerusalem. And I guess it's gone on for 7 months longer than Titus wanted it to. And he is probably quite angry by this point. Mm. And, you know, he wants to take the spoils. He wants to get it over with. And that involves finishing off the people who are inside, by and large.
And that's what he does. He takes his spoils. He takes prisoners. And he goes back to Rome. At this point, the war against Jerusalem is more or less over. There's mopping up to be done. But the fall of Jerusalem was the last thing to make that happen.
He doesn't need to be there in Judea anymore at this point. So, you know, the fact that the general isn't needed, and of course the leaders have been taken captive, this is no longer a problem in Roman eyes.
But the fact that it happened and that it was Titus that was in charge of this siege, that was the general and the leader here, how important is that in his career later on?
I guess it's what he becomes known for and has received a triumph for. Although he isn't given the name Judaicus, which is stressed by some of our sources, which is something that you might have expected. Generals in the past, for example, if they've had a triumph over the Germanic peoples, then they get the name like Germanicus.
Yes.
We know about a Germanicus from the past.
And Claudius got Britannicus for the same reason.
Exactly. But this doesn't happen here, which I think is interesting and maybe to do with the fact that it's not Vespasian who is actually there at the end, and maybe it would be too great an honour for someone who's not emperor yet. Either way, he gets lots of honours. There are statues put up, and most famously in what we still have, he has an arch at the edge of the forum, which is probably erected after his death, almost certainly by his brother Domitian. But that's a kind of ongoing spectacle, a monument that still commemorates Titus and specifically his victory over Jerusalem. It's a triumphal arch. It's something that is put up there to remember his great victory.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you subscribe to our other podcast, When in Rome, the next episode will look directly at the Arch of Titus. You can subscribe to Emperors of Rome on iTunes, and we've also got a Facebook page where we will always be happy to hear from you. If you want to give your perspective on Titus, that'd be the place to do it. Rhiannon and myself are on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. The next episode of Emperors of Rome will look at the life of Titus and his time as an emperor. So until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.